CODA, Youth Interventions for an Addicted World. Society's heavy and increasing use of fossil fuels, despite those fuels' documented harms, and despite persistent science-based calls for reducing their use, is recognized by many as a kind of societal addiction, an addiction of society itself. This societal addiction bears many resemblance to addictions with which individuals struggle. Standard descriptions of personal addiction, that is, addiction of individual persons, typically characterize it as entailing a felt, compulsive, and chronic need for the habit-forming substance or activity, despite that substance's or activity's harmful physical, psychological, or social consequences for oneself or others. The addicted individual often tries to quit using, but just cannot seem to make it happen. He or she instead ends up using more and more of the substance to which they are addicted. This is how it is with a social entity's addiction, too. The social entity knows that its using is causing harm to itself and others, maybe tries to quit or cut back, but instead just keeps using more and more. Imagine an individual addict asking their counselor whether they might be addicted to a certain substance. The counselor might ask, "Have you sometimes thought about cutting down or controlling your use? Have you ever tried to cut down or control your use, but it just didn't work? Have you continued to use even against your better judgment, and even though there have been negative consequences to your health, job, or family?" Affirmative answers to those questions signal the presence of an addiction. Now, imagine a social entity, like a nation, for example, going to its experts and asking similar questions about its overuse of fossil fuels. Is the entity aware of the damage its using is causing? Has the entity ever thought about cutting back on its using, maybe even tried to, but just has not been able to? Has the entity continued to use, even increased its usage, despite all the negative consequences to its people and families and environment? Affirmative answers to these questions signal the presence of an addiction. If the individual's addiction continues to worsen, if it causes more and more damage and disarray in the addict's life and in the lives of people around them, then family, friends, and workmates may begin to wonder if the time has finally arrived to conduct a formal intervention. In just the same way as a social entity's addiction to fossil fuels continues unabated, concerned citizens are beginning to seriously ask if the time has finally come to conduct a formal intervention. Young people and the youth climate courts they organize can serve exactly that function, a necessary, life-saving, formal intervention to save the addicted social communities they love. David Boyd, United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Environment, in his 2019 Safe Climate report, says it straight. Quote, "Society is addicted to fossil fuels. Despite 27 years of commitments dating back to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the world is neither headed in the right direction nor addressing the crisis at an adequate pace. Since 1990, global energy consumption has increased by 57%. the share of the world's total energy supply provided by fossil fuels has remained unchanged at 81%. Coal use is up 68%, oil use is up 36%, and natural gas use is up 82%. Even the fossil fuel share of electricity production has increased from 62% in 1992 to 65% in 2016. Global greenhouse gas emissions are up 60% since 1990. Wealthy people and large corporations are deeply invested in the status quo and use their immense economic and political power to resist the societal transformation needed to successfully address climate change." End quote. We all know that when an individual person is addicted to a substance, their use of that substance tends to increase over time. Dr. Boyd shows here that the same pattern happens when a social entity is addicted to fossil fuels. If we step back for a moment and look at the larger pattern of how an individual's addiction to a chemical substance develops, we will see virtually identical analogs to the way a social entity's addiction develops. We see, for example, that when an individual or a social body is first introduced to a new chemical, that chemical can initially prove very powerful at accomplishing its purpose and can seem, to all appearances, to be all upside and no downside. This was certainly the circumstance with opioid pain medications in the case of individuals, for example, and with chemical pesticides, synthetic plastics, and fossil fuels in the case of social entities. When Sigmund Freud, for example, first began using cocaine, he found that it seemed to work wonders in increasing his energy, acuity, and productivity. Only later, with continued and increasing usage, did the deep biological and psychological destruction start to become clinically evident. Many addictions begin with a period like that, sometimes shorter, sometimes longer, with an experience of successful pain relief, for example, or of accomplishment, capability, and power. Only at some later point is it discovered that while the successes felt large and real in the beginning, with time and continued use, those effects diminish and something ominous begins to happen. This beneath-the-surface sense of damage may not have been evident in the first flushes of success, may indeed have not made any appearance at all, and may not even have existed at that point. And yet, with time, with continued use, with continued reliance on the new substance, and with the strengthening of habit and dependence, the downside effects begin to emerge, slowly at first, then faster and faster. We may try to not think about the downsides. We may willfully choose to avoid thinking about the destructiveness as long as we can. But eventually, real damage is done, and the harms of using become increasingly and insistently evident. Unfortunately, by the time awareness of the damage does finally force itself into consciousness, some unavoidably strong, deep, and powerful personal habits have already taken root. The individual, or the social entity, has developed a web of daily practices, life habits, social structures, and even life beliefs that have come to feel normal and necessary. In a word, the addicted individual or social entity has developed a dependence on the substance. Use of the substance has worked its way deep into all the intersecting patterns and substructures of life and is now experienced as a need. Quitting seems impossible. It has been tried, and it just has not worked. It feels like there is no practical way up from what feels like abject despair. When no realistic, feasible way forward looks remotely possible, things seem hopeless. That is when a well-planned, gentle, insistent, caring, forcefully direct, and powerful intervention can make all the difference to the addicted person. The addict usually does know, perhaps only at some dark, quasi-conscious level, that their using needs to end, and that, in fact, they desperately want it to end. And yet, when that intervention does finally happen, it can initially feel to the desperate addict like the interveners are opposing them, fighting them, interfering with their needs, not helping them, and definitely not on their side. Yet, in some deep way, the addict also knows, just as the interveners do, that the addiction is out of control and the addict desperately needs help. Such an intervention, difficult, challenging, and painful as it often is, can turn out to be what ultimately saves that addict's life. Months or years later, the recovering addict may feel deep gratitude to the family and friends who loved them enough to apply that pressure, forcing them to do what they themselves had long known they needed to do. For a social entity, too, introduction to a new substance can initially feel wonderful, as if it is all upside and no downside. In the case of fossil fuels, this all upside and no downside perspective lasted for many decades, perhaps for most of a century, before the all too serious health impacts, environmental impacts, human rights impacts, and climate impacts started to become so abundantly clear. By the time societies recognized the downsides, though, whole economic, political, and social structures had been built up that relied on those fuels, chemicals, and plastics. The initial immense upsides, unparalleled in human history, made it easy for societies to overlook or deliberately ignore the downsides of fossil fuel extraction and usage. Some policymakers may even have calculated that the adverse health impacts, the increased mortality and social inequities experienced by a certain percentage of the population were simply an unfortunate but necessary social cost if societies were to enjoy the new benefits. These policymakers may have made the same moral calculation as those who stayed in Omelas, in Ursula Le Guin's famous little short story, The Ones Who Walked Away from Omelas. Le Guin's story imagines a community, Omelas, in which the happy bliss of the community's members depends on the horrendous suffering of one small child, and then explores the justness of such an arrangement. At some point in the social entity's addiction, though, the downsides become much too obvious to ignore. The climate impacts, the health impacts, the ecosystem and species loss impacts simply become too publicly evident to ignore, especially when those downsides threaten to destroy all the upsides as well. This seems to be the point the world's governments are approaching now. It is at exactly this point in a personal addiction that a planned intervention by caring family, friends, and workmates can be powerfully clarifying and effective. A young child tearfully confronting their alcoholic or drug-addled father, begging him to please, please stop, please go to treatment. Quote, if you won't do it for my sake, then please at least do it for your own. Quote. A powerful, love-inspired intervention like that can truly make all the difference. Because governments are the primary organs of formal policymaking in societies, it is governments, especially local governments, that will need the interventions of these young, caring, insistent, and organized youth climate courts. The youth courts can caringly, directly, pointedly, and unambiguously clarify the issues for their government. They can exert pressure, tough love pressure, on local governments that have so far failed to enact the necessary policies and laws to guide their communities into a healthy future. Thus, the young people who organize these youth climate court trials are performing an intervention on behalf of the people, communities, and planet they love. The local governments in these communities may already realize that they need to make big changes, but so far most just have not done so. Governments, like people, can sometimes just get stuck and find themselves unable to imagine any realistic, workable way forward until they are forced to. In today's climate crisis, youth climate court interventions can provide that extra measure of moral force a government needs to begin making the changes it has not, until now, known how to do. So the test now is whether the intervention work done by these caring young people and their youth climate courts will be effective in confronting our social addiction, and whether local governments will take the message as seriously as their young people do. When good, concerned young leaders discover this youth climate court option and find it intriguing, they may decide that they want to give it a go. They may feel excited by the idea, enlivened and empowered, and recognize it as a new and powerful way for them to speak their truth with a public voice and to exercise real, genuine, efficacious agency, providing a sincere, urgent, and much-needed intervention in a crisis that is already impacting and will continue to dramatically impact their lives so directly. And when good, caring city mayors and council members and county boards of commissioners find themselves and their government summoned to participate in a youth climate court, they will realize how important it is for them to not offhandedly dismiss what young people are asking of them, as a fearful addict might want to do, but to instead engage respectfully and caringly in the important intervention work the Youth Climate Court is courageously undertaking. Local governments will hopefully realize, too, how crucially important it is that they respond with grace and generosity, grateful to the youth organizers for the genuineness, care, and passion they bring to their intervention work. It will be essential that elected officials encourage and give full respect to the young organizers and to the well-meaning intervention work they are struggling to accomplish. Smart elected officials will recognize right away how truly valuable these youth climate courts can be for them, and will welcome them and their organizers as allies in the hard work of governing in our desperately climate-challenged world.